Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. This week, a recent letter from Captain James Robinson of the Irish Maritime Forum on our maritime domain and its protection. Kinsale or NLI celebrate their third award, plus a new pontoon is in place on the Aran Islands. Hugh Oram on the life and times of Ivan Beshoff and his journey from his native Ukraine to Dublin. Over the past two decades, we've carried coverage on the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group, talking to Simon Barrow and Padraig Hooley, to name but two. So yesterday, Seascapes headed to West Cork to speak to Padraig Hooley of the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group on recent findings and the work of the group. We wondered what it was that sparked Padraig's interest in the first place in cetaceans.
I think I was probably an 8 or 9 year old fishing off the back of the pier in Greystones, not in County Wicklow, not a well-known sort of hotspot for cetaceans. And I remember it was an incredible experience. The sky just went electric. The pressure, the barometer started to drop. It started to rain intensely. And all the dubs went back into their cars and headed back in the 84 bus back to Dublin. And myself and this old boy from Liverpool just had a sense that we'd stay on. And we started catching fish that we had never caught before. We were catching multiple species on the same line. And we thought, geez, this was amazing. We'd never seen so many species of fish before. And then I saw three dorsal fins coming in from the Brayhead side. And I thought, God, sharks. And of course, I took out what I call my killer lure, which was a great big spinner, and started chucking it out. And I realized that they were dolphins. And in hindsight, they were bottlenose dolphins. And my first interaction with bottlenose dolphins or any cetacean species in Ireland was to put on my killer lure and try and catch them. We generally like the look of, you know, here in Ireland and in particular along the south coast, that we have almost a 9 month whale season. The only low period during that is really kind of right now. You're talking, you know, March, April, May tends to be a little bit on the quiet front. But, you know, any week now we're expecting the arrival of, you know, the planet's second largest shark, the basking sharks. Minke whales have already started being sighted from Donegal all the way down to Schleyhead. Things are even. There's a suggestion or a hint out there that the season is beginning to kickstart. In the last month, we've had three incredible connections linking Ireland's whales to high latitude feeding grounds in the Arctic Circle. One was one of our humpback whales here that was photographed off Towhead in West Cork. A couple of weeks later, it turned up off the Dutch coast. And then last year, the same humpback whale was photographed off northern Norway, Tromsø, 300 miles inside the Arctic Circle. Another humpback whale we've just linked that was here off Schleyhead and West Kerry in September, 7 weeks earlier, last summer in July, was photographed off Húsavík in northeastern Iceland. And now this story about this bowhead whale, which is a whale species we don't have in Irish waters. It's an Arctic species, but it was satellite tagged with one of the very early sort of test, if you like, satellite tags in 2002, you know, 12, 13 years ago. And it stuck to its target for 19 days. And obviously they were kind of designed to break off and the whale goes about and does its thing. But this satellite tag for the last 12 years has drifted aimlessly in the North Atlantic. And it turns up last week on a beach in Connemara. And of course, the scientists who put it, the Danish scientists based in Greenland who put it on, were delighted because all of a sudden, you know, they're going to get, you know, far more information than they ever could have possibly thought that they were going to get from this tag. But it's important to note that this tag wasn't attached to a whale when it washed up on the beach. So again, these three anecdotes, well, they're not anecdotes, they're confirmed now. They just show us, give us a fantastic insight into the movements and the ecology of these whales, and serve to remind us that, of course, they're not Irish whales. These are animals that are merely using Ireland as a staging post, either going south to the breeding grounds or heading north to the feeding grounds.
And I suppose in recent weeks, when people hear the word whale, they're very much reminded of the controversy of the Japanese still hunting the whales in the Southern Ocean. And of course, the UN have enforced that ban that has been the bane of anybody who cares about the species for some years now.
Yeah, I mean, it was the International Court of Justice. This court case has been running now for quite a few years. And in fairness to the Australians, they did their homework on it, and they basically had the gumption to do what a lot of, you know, other nations probably should have done. They challenged the Japanese, and every country has a right to kill whales, to whale. There's a protocol for so doing. For instance, the Norwegians and the Icelandics, they whale legitimately, rightly or wrongly, because they have objected to the moratorium. They said from day one, we disagree with this moratorium. We have a national interest here. We're going to kill whales. And they do. The Japanese adopted a different approach. We're going to basically, you know, tell a big fib. We're going to tell everybody we're doing science. And they've killed, since they started this program a decade ago, they've killed 3,600 minke whales, and they've published 2 scientific papers on it. Now, I would expect a 20-year-old student doing a master's or a PhD, without killing a single whale, would publish 2 or 3 scientific peer-reviewed papers. So with such a low publication rate, basically the Hague court said, listen, this is absolute nonsense. You can go down, and if you're seriously engaged in science, you can do your science, but you're going to have to do it using non-lethal methods. And it's fantastic. Now, I don't think for a moment it's the end of the story. The Japanese have actually not a very long history in whaling, but there's a certain amount of national pride at stake here, and I would say that they will probably put in an objection to it, and it's not the end of the game. An interesting point, however, is that the primary reason that the Japanese have a long-haul whaling program, they're going down to Antarctica to kill their whales, is because the Americans dropped 2 atomic bombs on Japan in 1945 to bring an end to their involvement in the Second World War. And it was a suggestion by MacArthur in the MacArthur Plan, when the Japanese said, we have nothing to eat. You've demolished our country. Our people are starving. And MacArthur almost, you know, sort of glibly said, eat whales. That's what they did. They started international whaling. And of course, now everybody, the Americans included, are protesting because the Japanese are killing, in fairness, a relatively small number of a very common whale species in Antarctica. So I just say that because people get very animated about whaling because they see the images and they're not pleasant. They're very visceral. And clearly, it is more a welfare issue than a conservation issue. Whether the Japanese go down to Antarctica and kill a couple of hundred minke whales is really, to be perfectly blunt about it, neither here nor there. But it's the optics of it. It is a bloody awful business to be in. There is no humane way of killing a whale. But, you know, the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group would consistently say that there are far more serious threats, conservation threats to whales and dolphins. And, you know, an obvious one, we were just chatting earlier about it, is this one, say, of the navies using low and mid-frequency active sonar. And just in the last week, you know, half a dozen Cuvier's beaked whales have washed up dead and dying on beaches in Crete because we're doing something very simple, like using, on a training exercise, this sound. Of course, it's all increasing the amount of noise pollution in our oceans. So our oceans are increasingly becoming not nice places for whales and dolphins to live. And of course, a lot of this, we are responsible because we are making our oceans busier and noisier places and a less favourable habitat for whales to live in. That really, if we could sort out these issues and issues like fisheries, bycatch, we would be going a long way towards protecting whales and dolphins. You know, whales and dolphins, they're smart, they're sentient, and importantly, they're sociable mammals. So, I mean, a lot of these animals that we see now swimming around concrete tanks in the likes of SeaWorld, they've either been captured in the wild or they've been inbred in captivity. I mean, the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group have consistently said, if you want to see whales, sit up on a headland with a pair of binoculars or go out in a whale watching boat in a way that you're not impacting on them. But we hear it down here in West Cork all the time. People who want to, say, go out in a whale watching boat with the likes of Colin Barnes, people saying, oh, am I guaranteed to see whales? And I say to them, well, you know, really, if you want to be guaranteed to see any sort of wildlife, and whales in particular, you know, go to SeaWorld. In fact, don't go to SeaWorld, because, you know, you're seeing them in a horrible environment. But, you know, it does set up an unrealistic expectation for people that, oh God, I can see whales, but to see them, what, I really have to sit in a cliff top for an hour or two? Absolutely. absolutely. But the rewards for doing your own whale watching in a way that you're not impacting on whales, sitting on a headland with a pair of binoculars on a nice calm day and you see a whale, God, that is such a wonderful and joyous thing to experience, rather than, you know, paying SeaWorld to look at these poor unfortunate animals whose life expectancy in captivity is pitiful. I mean, your average killer whale in captivity lives for something like 3 to 5 years. Killer whales in the wild, females in particular, can live 70 to 80 years. And of course, they keep bringing out Shamu 1. The Shamu now in SeaWorld in San Diego is Shamu number 16 or something like that. Of course, the kids don't realise that, you know. So if you're listening and you're going to Florida or you're going to SeaWorld, whatever, don't go to SeaWorld. There's plenty of places nowadays where you can go and see these animals safely in the wild. And of course, whale watching is just is a real niche tourism product now in West Cork, in Kerry, growing in Waterford. I mean, the contagion is spreading. It is fantastic. And it's great for the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. The more people that are out there watching whales, either out in boats or sitting up on headlands or clifftops, the easier it is for people to interact with whales and to become involved in their conservation. And of course, that's where the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group is most interested in encouraging members of the public to go out and see whales, but to report what they see back to the Whale and Dolphin Group, and report strandings as well. If you're walking along a beach and you see a rotting carcass of a whale or a dolphin, report it to us, because even though you might think it's not important, potentially to us, these strandings tell us a very important story of perhaps why these animals are dying sort of out of sight and out of mind. That's important.
Now, we mentioned the bowhead whale earlier and the fact that the tag was discovered from it. And I was astonished before I came down to see you here in West Cork that it is one of the longest living whales. Some of them have been reckoned to live for over 300 years, which is remarkable.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It is a very difficult one. It's almost impossible. Well, there are new techniques, cutting edge genetic techniques that are coming in now, using all sorts of complicated sort of chemical processes that are way above my pay grade to talk about with any fluency. The large whales, the baleen whales, are really, really difficult to age. I think with the toothed whales, like the smaller whales, like porpoises and dolphins, it is possible because you can section the teeth. And a bit like counting the rings on a tree, you can count the dentine layers on toothed whales. With baleen whales, up to now, it has been almost impossible. So I think there's wild speculation. And certainly that 300 years is very much on the upper end of the speculation. But certainly some of the whales, it is thought, can probably in and around 100 years is topping it. But it is amazing. We know relatively, even with all the techniques and, you know, satellite telemetry and GPS and all the with all the people out studying and looking and photographing and taking biopsy samples, what we know about these large creatures that are visiting the Irish south coast in particular, and places like, you know, Cork and Waterford and Kerry and the like, what we know about them is still relatively little in terms of, you know, we're struggling we don't even know where they're born. You know, these iconic whales, like humpback whales that visit us and return, individuals returning here year after year after year. You know, some of these individuals now have personalities because, you know, one classic one is Boomerang. We can't get rid of him. He keeps coming back, you know. But we don't know where this humpback whale or any of our humpback whales were born. So we don't know, are they Cape Verdean? Are they African? Are they from the Caribbean on the other side of the Atlantic pond? Or are they from an unknown breeding ground? So the numbers of questions. I mean, I'm regularly in primary schools and you have 8-year-olds asking me questions about whales and the answer is simply, we don't know. So, you know, really, although we know an awful lot more than we did 20 years ago when the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group started, you know, it's a big, big mosaic and many of the pieces are missing. But that's what makes it all so fascinating.
Last night I heard the call of my last companions, the roar of the harpoon gun, and now I swim alone. I thought of our days gone by, when we were thousands, but I know that I soon must die, the last Leviathan. My soul has been torn from me, and I am bleeding. My heart, it has been rent, and I am crying. as the beauty around me fades, and I am screaming, I am the last of the great whales, and I am dying. This morning the sun did rise, crimson in the north sky. The ice was the colour of blood, and I heard the wind sigh. I rose for to take a breath, it was my last one. From a gun came the roar of death, and now I am done. My soul has been torn from me, and I am bleeding. My heart, it has been rent, and I am crying. As the beauty around me fades, and I am screaming, I am the last of the great whales, and I am dying. I am the last of the great whales, and I am dying.
The Last Leviathan, performed by the Mallgoggers from Cove and taken from their recent CD, Maiden Voyage. We were speaking to Padraig Hooley of the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. You can read and see more about the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group by visiting www.iwdg.ie. Captain James Robinson, in a recent letter to the Irish Times, responding to Colonel Dorica Lee's article on the decline of our armed forces, had this to say. Colonel Lee's article is timely, coming as it does between green and white papers on defence. The Irish Maritime Forum shares Colonel Lee's concern at the low percentage of GDP allocated to defence. In the context of the vastly increased sea area claimed by Ireland, the Forum advocates an increase in the allocation to maritime security. The area of operations to be covered by the Navy has more than doubled since the publication of the last Defence White Paper. To patrol the area encompassed by the 200-mile exclusive economic zone, which is approximately 410,000 square kilometres, the White Paper on Defence 2000 recommended 8 ships and 1,144 personnel. The defence and security of our hugely expanded maritime domain, now 1 million square kilometres, is surely worthy of an increase to a more realistic number of ships and personnel. We are an island nation, and we now claim the largest maritime domain to landmass of any northwestern European state. In fact, 92% of Ireland is underwater. This domain contains natural resources with a potential value of several trillion euro, including mineral deposits, fossil fuels, marine life, fisheries, and wind and wave energy. Effective policing of our maritime domain is an important indicator of our determination to exploit our marine resources effectively and sustainably. Yours, etc., Captain James Robinson, on behalf of the Irish Maritime Forum. Captain James Robinson is a past president of the Nautical Institute. Next here on Seascapes, to a remarkable man from the Ukraine who left an indelible mark on Dublin, where he settled after the turn of the last century. Hugh Oram has the story of Ivan Beshov.
With Ukraine so much in the news these days, it's opportune to recall the man who is perhaps the best-known Ukrainian to have lived in Ireland, Ivan Beshov. He ended up starting a chain of fish and chip shops in Dublin, and today the Beshov name is still well regarded on various fish and chip shops and with a Howth-based seafood company. As for Ivan, he had been born Ivan Beshaiko, the son of a judge near Odessa in southwestern Ukraine. As a young man, he was involved in the movement against Tsarist rule in Russia and promptly found himself in prison. When he was released, he signed up to serve on the battleship Potemkin, almost brand new, and the pride of the Tsar's Black Sea naval fleet. Ivan served as a mechanic in the engine room. The famous mutiny on the battleship in 1905 began because of the awful food served to the crew. It was more maggots than proper meat, so a revolt got underway, and Ivan played a leading role. The mutiny started at sea, and the ship then put into Odessa, where a full-scale revolt began against the Tsar's regime. Eventually, the ship managed to leave Odessa, and it sailed for nearly a fortnight, without provisions, until it docked in Romania. Most of the crew escaped, and Ivan's fellow sailors ended up scattered all over the world. As for Ivan, he dyed his hair with boiled walnut juice and changed his name to Beshov. He went on to Turkey and from there to Holland, ending up in London in 1906, the year after the mutiny. And in London, he met up with both Lenin and Trotsky. Just before the First World War, he decided he wanted to emigrate and settle down in America. En route, he ended up in Dublin, where he managed to miss the sailing, and he stayed the rest of his life in Ireland, and here the young revolutionary became a veteran capitalist. In Dublin, he found it difficult to get work, but teamed up for a time with the Russian oil company, which was then trading in Ireland. Ivan was fond of fish, so he decided to go into business for himself, first opening a small cafe at Usher's Quay. And later he opened a fish and chip shop on the North Strand, but when German bombers caused so much havoc there in 1941, the shop was wrecked. He remained undaunted, and the business carried on elsewhere and expanded over the years. Ivan married a local woman, Noreen Mulcahy, who came from County Tipperary, and they had five sons and a daughter. Ivan himself, although fluent in Russian and Ukrainian, never managed to master English completely, but he stayed at work full-time until he was 82 years old. In his earlier years, his background got him into trouble. It was even said of him that not long after he'd arrived in Dublin, he turned up in the GPO to give the 1916 rebels some practical advice on how to conduct a revolution. And soon after the Free State came into being, he was imprisoned as a Russian spy, which of course was totally untrue. A decade later, in the early 1930s, despite being very friendly with Eamon de Valera, he once again found himself imprisoned, this time in Limerick Jail. As for the revolt on the battleship Potemkin, it is often seen as the mutiny that eventually sparked the Russian Revolution in 1917. A silent movie called The Battleship Potemkin was directed in 1925 in Russia by Sergei Eisenstein. It's considered one of the greatest films ever made, despite its Soviet propaganda themes. Ivan himself didn't manage to see the film until the 1980s, when a remastered version was premiered in Geneva. When he was 100, he was feted by the then Taoiseach, Charles Haughey. Ivan told him that in the Ukraine, if you get to 100, you are still considered a boy. Haughey presented him with a bottle of Irish whiskey. Ivan loved whiskey rather than vodka and drank gallons of the stuff, yet it had no effect on him. And at this particular do, Charlie Haughey had to pour his glass of whiskey into a flower pot behind Ivan's back to make sure he was still sober afterwards. Ivan lived on until 1987, aged either 106 or 108. No one was quite sure of his real age. The man who became so connected with fish and chips in Dublin was the last surviving member of the mutiny aboard the battleship Potemkin, so he had secured his own little niche in history, while the mutiny itself has become embedded in the fables of Ukraine and Russia.
Hugh Oram, on Ivan Beshef. Volunteer lifeboat crew with Aran Islands RNLI will be able to launch their all-weather Severn-class lifeboat faster following the installation of a 24-metre pontoon, which will enable the lifeboat crew to board the lifeboat from a newly installed berth. The new stable platform will also ensure that the transfer of casualties onto or from the lifeboat can be done more easily and more safely. You can read and see more on the Seascapes webpage. Last Friday night was a busy night for the volunteer crew of Kinsale RNLI as they collected two West Cork Community Awards for bringing to safety the 30 crew members of the training ship Astrid that sank outside Kinsale Harbour in July of last year. This brings to three the number of awards related to the Astrid. Earlier this year, the Irish Cruising Club presented Kinsale RNLI with the Waterford Cup, a perpetual trophy dating back to 1953. All three awards will be on display in Kinsale Yacht Club on this Sunday at 4 p.m. as a thank you to the Yacht Club members who played such a role in the Astrid rescue. Next week here on Seascapes, we talk to a former skipper who was one of the first contributors to the Irish Skipper, which last month celebrated its 50th anniversary serving the fishing industry. That man is Seamus Hayden. He told Seascapes about his career as a fisherman, author, and later manager of Swan Nets. And Seamus relates how Arthur Reynolds, the founding editor of the journal, approached him to write for the fledgling magazine back in 1964. We'll have all that and much more here on Seascapes. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.